The Art Dealer Diaries are brought to you by Medicine Man Gallery, located for over 26 years in Tucson, Arizona, specializing in antique Native American art, early Western art, including the famed Maynard Dixon, as well as modern art. You can find everything online at medicinemangallery.com. There's over 6,000 objects to select from. Also, the Charles Bloom Murder Mystery Series, written by yours truly, me, Mark Sublett. There are 7 books in the series, and they follow the protagonist Charles Bloom through all the intrigue of the art world set in Santa Fe and the Navajo Nation. These can be found on Audible, eBooks, Amazon, and of course, the gallery at medicinemangallery.com. I had Matt Smith on today, and he's such a good plein air painter. I've always been a fan. I was a collector before I ever represented him. You know, it took me 20 years before I was able to get Matt into the gallery. And it's fun to hear his story of how he got to be one of the best in the country. And he's renowned now for not only his paintings, but for his workshops and for his skill set that he shares with others. And it's a good one. If you're a painter and you want to be in, especially if you want to paint outdoors, this is a good one to listen to because he lets you know how difficult it can be. And not only that, but also the skill set that's needed and required and what it is required from you if you want to try to make art as your living, especially as a plein air painter. So Matt Smith, very fun. I think you'll enjoy it a great deal. I know I did.
So how are you doing? What's going on?
Oh, yeah.
Busy?
I am busy. How about you?
Too busy. so busy I can't be at the easel as much as I want. So,
well, that's not good. Is that
no?
That's bad for an artist. What kind
of it is? Just teaching, and I've been traveling a lot, which allows me to paint. So that's been great.
You've been traveling a lot. It's a pandemic. I've been traveling a lot. Where are you traveling to?
Oh gosh, I've been all over, up to Montana. I was in Colorado twice. Probably going to take off to Utah here pretty soon, get the last of fall color in the canyons.
Yeah. You know, so when you go on these trips, you're teaching, you're actually doing teaching trips?
No, the teaching I was referring to is I'm working with the Tucson Art Academy online. I have an online class that I do, and it's been very popular, so that takes up some time. It seems like just things coming up, little things that need to be addressed.
By the way, we have Matt Smith on today and we've been talking. We're already going, baby. This is part of the podcast right now. What is the Tucson Art Academy? I actually don't know what that is, which is pretty embarrassing, but I don't.
Well, you might know Gabor Zvagrik.
Oh, I know Gabor. Gabor's thing?
Yes, he had a brick and mortar there in Tucson for 5 years, and then he went exclusively online, I don't know, about 7 or 8 years ago. And now he's doing a lot of online video sales and workshops.
Oh, that's good. And he's a good painter. He's a really good painter.
He's a fine painter. He truly is, and I think that's why his school is successful, is because he knows who to chase in terms of the artists and tries to keep it, a high level, and he's done a phenomenal job. Both he and his wife, Christine, have done a phenomenal job.
And so do they, so everything is for online, as you're the teacher, the students come in, they do it online, they charge a fee for you, if you're a student, to be there, and then they also sell work too as well?
No, they're not really selling work right now. What they do, so when you join the class, you are signed up on a private Facebook page, a group page, and all the communication is done through there. They can post images. I can then take the images and alter them on an iPad Pro through Procreate and talk about foundational principles I think they need to observe on the particular paintings or whatever the issue is we're discussing. And there's a lot of communication amongst the students in the group. So it's been really phenomenal. It's been a lot of fun, and have some great folks in there. So it's been a good deal.
And how many people would be in a group like that taking class?
Well, it depends. I don't want to mention a number because people kind of flip out over that, but it's been popular.
Okay, now that really intrigued me, that what you just said, that you sounded like a politician there.
I probably did a bit.
You don't want to mention the number because it, if it's big, that's a good thing, or the competition, or?
No, because it's a big number, and people generally look at a workshop as 15 students, which right. is what I limit my in-person workshops to.
Right.
This is a year-round class, so when you sign up, it's for a full year. So even though the number of students is large, the individual attention is still pretty pure. You know, they get as much out of the class as they put into it. Some of the folks never respond. They just sort of watch the post and read what's going on, and others are very active. So,
it's like any college class, big freshman class. I mean, I remember
sure.
organic chemistry with 400 people. 98% of them were in and out. I spent every day at the professor's office trying to figure it out, and knew him by heart, and you know, he became a friend because I wanted something out of that class.
Sure.
And part of it is I wanted an A, but part of it is I just wanted to understand it. And so it's probably the kind of the same thing. It's you guys, the people that are really interested and really want to do it, they get a lot of time.
They do. It's like anything. Some of the folks coming in are very serious, probably even professional. Some of them are actually, and some are a hobbyist or just starting. So it's all different levels of participation. And like I say, it's whatever they want to put into it.
And do you do it? Can we see their face on the thing, or is it just your image? In other words, can you actually see the students, or is it just like chat room kind of a thing, and they see you?
It's just personal communication. So mostly I'm typing my answers out. I do video clips that I add in. The course comes with approximately 10 hours of video. I post an additional video, short, quick video covering different subjects once a month they're about 10 minutes long. But, you know, I've been doing this for about a year and a half. So there are quite a few of them up there. So there's a lot of content where they don't need to communicate with me. When they do, they just like any typical Facebook post, you can just write a question, or you can ask a question, include one of your images, your reference, whether you're out in the field or working from photo reference or drawings, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then we talk about it.
But if you want to get that content, access that content, you have to pay through the Tucson Art Academy to be able to access it, correct?
Yes.
Okay, you just couldn't go to Facebook or YouTube?
No, okay. You have to register for the class, and then you're able to join. We let you into the group.
Do you ever think you were going to be an art teacher? Because you really are in a lot of ways, and in a lot of different formats.
Well, I tell you what, I've taught for 30 years, mostly in-person workshops, week-long workshops. I started at the Scottsdale Art School, so I've done them all over the country. And have really enjoyed the communication with other people. You know how it is when you're an artist, you're in a studio or alone, or I'm out in the desert alone talking to maybe some lizards or something. So to get with a group of people who are like-minded and want to share ideas, I really enjoy it. The advantage of this online class is it's allowed me to respond to the students wherever I am, as long as I have a Wi-Fi or a cell signal. So I can do it here in my studio in the morning, just take an hour or two in the morning or whatever it is, and then maybe click in the afternoon. I can do it in a hotel room in Red Lodge, Montana. It doesn't matter. Or in my camper in the middle of nowhere, as long as I can sync to my phone. So it's been great. And my timing couldn't have been better given COVID, because all the workshops closed, all the galleries were closed, and the checks kept coming. So it was great.
Yeah. No, having an internet presence of some type is a very good thing. I mean, even though we were closed from whatever, mid-March through June 1st, we were extremely busy just through the internet, quite frankly.
Well, you've been active on the internet. That's one of the things that I really admire about your gallery, not only your website, which is extensive, but on the social media platforms. And that's one thing I learned through all this, through Gabor, is the importance of a presence on Facebook, Instagram. I'm not real good about maintaining my website because my gallery sells the paintings for me, and that's been good. But it's it's important. And I think this whole COVID thing has shined the light on that for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, what we did when it hit, I said, okay, well, first of all, we had to put all the people at in remotely. So we set up remote lines so we could have high frequency lines, high broadband, good broadband for all our workers, because they all worked at home, basically. And then I decided, well, I'm just going to do as many educational videos as I can. And I just worked on those aggressively through that whole period of time. And I started an online auction, and I started an online magazine, Essential West Magazine. So I figured I would just add more content, more ways for people to find us. And, you know, all that's good for you guys too, all my artists, because it brings you more eyeballs, more clicks.
It does. And I think the educational component in terms of the art is really important. I watch a lot of those you post on Instagram, you know, about the tough bracelets or cast, you know, little jewelry things or baskets and whatever that. They're really informative, quick and easy to watch. And I think they're powerful. So
that's, we're doing more of that on for our artists as well. All our artists we're doing videos for their artwork. So when you bring in new artwork for me, you know, we're going to do a video montage of what you brought and your voice of what you have to say about these pieces. So we've really, you know, it helped us focus a little more. Now, we've spent an amazing amount of time on our internet anyway. We started our website in 96, but the last 10 years, we've really focused on our website from a financial and content and just making it usable, right? And easy to use. And so we're going to continue to do all that stuff and hopefully continue to be able to help all our artists make more sales, depending on how long, you know, these kind of things go on. This is going to go on for a while. We're going to be wearing a mask next year in the summer. If we don't think we are, we're kidding ourselves.
Well, I'm going to remain optimistic and just think that everybody is getting so sick of looking at the same old paintings on their walls that they're going to buy all new artwork over the next few months because they're all stuck at home.
Well,
on the internet.
Or in Tucson, everyone's moving to Tucson because, you know, they don't want to be in New York City. They don't want to be in LA. They don't want to be in San Francisco. Or they don't have to be because they can do their job anywhere. So you might as well be in a nice place like Phoenix or Tucson or those kind of – Tucson, actually, specifically, because it's not so big. And we have lots.
Correct. I tell you what, the cities are exploding. My travels over the last 2 months, I am just absolutely stunned at the number of people on the road. I went through Yellowstone to get to Beartooth Pass, and it was absolutely packed. This was in September, which is usually a little bit more calm, and every campground was full. It was just mob. Went through the edge of Jackson on the way down through the Tetons, and there were cars lined out on the road parked for common trailheads that it can't be fun like that with that many people. So I guess folks are getting out into the country to social distance. And
yeah, makes sense.
I see that is a good thing. And as long as they're not all out there at once.
Something you have been doing your entire life.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, which we're going to get into. We kind of just jumped into talking about business in some respects, but I want to kind of go back and start from the beginning with you, Matt. You know, I know some of your backstory, but I don't know it all. And I'm sure people would find it very interesting to know that story. So where did you grow up?
Here in Scottsdale. I was born in Kansas City, Missouri, and my parents relocated to Scottsdale when I was three in the early 60s. My father was with Motorola. And I've basically been here for most of my life. He had three assignments over in Europe, two that I was on with him as a youngster. We lived 2 years in Toulouse, France, mm-hmm. and 1 year in Geneva, Switzerland.
Wow.
For his work. So my mother was an art history major, so we were always traveling and visiting the museums, which was great. The bug bit me very early on. I love to draw and paint, and so we got the exposure, like I said, to a lot of really terrific art over there. And here in Scottsdale, that's where my connection to the Sonoran Desert happened and my love of the outdoors. And so I was drawing and painting as a kid. I started in my first gallery when I was in high school. And
how old were you when you did that?
I just turned 18. Took a painting in to get framed in the gallery. They had a frame shot in the back in a gallery. This was in Scottsdale, and they asked me if I wanted to show there, so that was nice.
What gallery?
It was the Martin Gallery.
Uh-huh.
You probably don't remember this. I've this goes that. Way back.
Yeah.
They were there in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so did they approach you when you brought it in? You got it, brought it in for framing, and they said, who are you showing with, kind of thing?
Yeah, when I came back, they said that they liked the painting and asked if I'd be interested in representation. And of course, I hadn't even thought about it. I said, well, sure, sure. So that was kind of fun. And
you think it was pivotal? You think that was pivotal and at that moment? Because you're getting ready to go to college, right? You're trying to figure out what you want to do as a life. Your dad sounds like a CEO type of guy that was business guy for sure for Motorola. It sounds like he's up the upper echelons of that company. And so was that a pivotal point, you think?
It helped solidify what I wanted to do, but at that point I still didn't think people made a living at selling paintings. You know, it'd be a struggle, so I was still trying to think about what I wanted to do. Right after that, I entered Arizona State University as a business marketing major, and took a drawing class as one of my electives. And one of the instructors or the instructor asked if I'd stay after class, and I thought, oh, what have I done, you know? and she said, you know, you're really good and serious with this. What are you an art major? I said, no, I'm business. And she said, well, you need to come over to the art department. And I thought about it, and the next semester I did, and I registered as a painting major and worked there for a while. I quickly got frustrated at the sort of the abstract, you know, conceptual nature of the program. You know, Mark, I was going down into Scottsdale and seeing all these great galleries with just terrific artwork. I remember the old James Fowler gallery and Abe Hayes and Trailside and Biltmore. I mean, I go in these galleries and see this absolutely phenomenal art. Then I go down to ASU and they're just basically telling me to emote on canvas. And I'm trying to learn the structural fundamental tools of painting, and I wasn't getting it. So I went up to Northern Arizona University for a year, figured out that was the same thing. You'll get a kick out of this. I came back down here and Merrill Mahaffey was teaching at Phoenix College. So I pulled out ASU and went over and registered for several painting classes with him over there. He took an interest in me, which I really appreciated, and hired me as an assistant in his studio. And so I did that for a little over a year, and then he ended up moving, and I went back into Arizona State, thought, well, I'm just going to finish my degree, and at least I'll have that, and I can teach.
Right.
Uh-huh. You know, if the painting thing doesn't work out, and right. Yeah, so that's kind of...
What did your mom and dad think? I'm sure your mom was kind of thrilled, but was your dad, what did he think when you got out of business part and said, I'm going to become an artist?
He was concerned. He's my biggest fan now, yeah. But he was very concerned. And even when I graduated, he said, "Hey, listen, I can get you an entry level job over at Motorola if you want to do that." And I said, "Well, you know, I've done the whole major in art thing, and I'm just going to give it a whirl. So I'll get back to you on that."
Yeah, and you never had to do that part, right?
I never had to do that.
And your mom, was she thrilled? I assume she was, as an art.
I think she was concerned too, but she was excited for me. She initially, in school, registered as an art major and decided she didn't have the skill set to pursue it and went into art history. So she was, I think she was excited. She was excited about what I was doing and that I actually could do something with it. And, but, you know, kind of was supportive, but concerned.
Did you have any other brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters and a brother.
And were they, what do they do?
My brother is a business man over in Laguna Niguel in California. My two sisters live here. My younger sister owns Source Tech. They make the high-end oil prime artist panels.
Mm.
And my older sister is married to a gentleman who, just recently retired from Sperry.
And the Source Tech sister, how did she get into that? Just curiosity. was.
Through me.
She might be a connection.
Yeah, it's actually a funny story. SourceTech was actually, initially, the guy she married, Will Pierce, owned a company called SourceTech, and what he did was maintain and repaired and sold parts for what are the machines that banks take your money out of? ATMs.
Yeah.
So that was when they were the old school, and as they were transitioning into digital, he was trying to decide whether he wanted to do that and stick with that. At the same time, they had employed a couple of my nephews, but they didn't. They were in high school, kind of thing. And I said, "Oh, this is great. Can I show you how to make panels and then you pay the boys to do that so that I don't ever have to do it again?" And they said, "No, we don't want to do that. We want nothing to do with that." Well, eventually they did. And it just took off like a rocket. And that was right when Will was trying to decide if he wanted, like I say, wanted to continue, and quickly realized, "Hey, I'd rather do this." So that's what he did.
So they turned the ATM machine company into a panel for art company and kept the name.
There you go.
Yeah. That's funny.
And they sell a lot of panels.
And do they sell them everywhere, all over the world? And
it's mail order only. They sell them all over the world.
And how did their business doing during the pandemic? Did it increase?
No, it's done very well. I mean, I said increase.
Yeah. I would expect it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
People are like, "Oh, well, I might as well take up painting," or artists are going, "I might as well paint." Yeah, I would think they would be busy.
Yeah, no, they've stayed very busy, and it's been good for them. And it's been a great little business for them. I'm real happy for them.
You get a discount?
No, I don't ask for one because I don't want people to think that I'm part ownership in the business. I'm not. They take care of me because I buy in quantity, but I get the same deal. And they have some pretty good endorsers, other fellow artists like Bill Anton and Ralph Warburg and the like. So
yeah, well, we'll give a shout out to SourceTech. If you need your panels for art, SourceTech.
Campuspanels.com. There you go.
There you go. We gave your sister and your brother-in-law a little hit.
So you
get through college. You have a BFA, I assume, in art, correct?
In painting.
And painting, yes, and that was front, and actually was ASU where you ultimately ended up getting that, right?
Yes,
that's where they signed off. And then what did you do?
And then I'll never forget walking away from my last class, thinking I just got ripped off. I think I had $300 in my pocket, so I drove up to Canon and spent a month on the road painting. I came home and decided, okay, I've got to take control of this now. So I started really looking up some of the artists I admired. Kurt Walters was very helpful, Jim Reynolds, Clyde Aspavig, Michael Lynch, and took some workshops with them, became friends with many of them, and got a lot of help from them. They put me on the right path, and I just worked hard and starved. And I got married not long after I graduated, 6 months or so.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife at the time worked, so that helped. I worked hard. I didn't
painting
know
at, at that time, was it? Because we're talking what? This is like the 77?
No, this was the mid 80s.
So I
graduated in 85.
Okay.
And yeah.
And was playing.
I took my time, Mark.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seemed like my timeline was more like what it should have been, but.
No, I took a couple semesters off and a couple of semesters where I was just taking 6 hours and I worked, you know, full time. So, just to pay for school and bills.
And so was plein air a thing? It was just kind of taking off, starting right about that time, right? I mean, as far as, clearly it's been done for a long time, but there was a point, especially in the early 90s, mid 90s, even late 90s, it was really a hot thing. So were you kind of at the front of that wave?
Yes, and as far as you call it the wave, I mean, it was was the one comment I got from all those names I just mentioned was, "Matt, you've got to get yourself French easel and go outside and paint from direct observation." So I did. And I was out there when nobody was out there. Nobody, I didn't even know the term plein air. Never saw anybody else outdoors. But I was doing it. I was doing it all year long here in the desert, even in the summer when it was 115, 116 degrees. I was having so much fun. I didn't know I was broken hot. And and it just started building. And I kept seeing improvements in my work, which kept me excited. And around 1990, things started picking up a little better with shows and galleries. And 1993, I started with Trailside, which was a big deal.
Did they have anybody like you, doing, plein air and doing strictly landscape paintings like that type in their roster at that time?
They did. They had Clyde Aspavig. They had Scott Christensen. They had Kurt Walters. Kurt Walters was a big proponent of painting from direct observation and was very active with that. The whole plein air thing, I wasn't really paying attention to it. I was just painting and trying to get better and figure out how to get better. And then, of course, the plein air movement, like you said, took off around the mid-90s and really kicked in by early 2000.
Yeah, and so you were positioned at that point to be kind of the leaders in the field, at a fairly young age, really.
Well, I became known for it and got a reputation for it. I still do a lot of work in the studio. I don't do everything outdoors. The studio is a great place. It's a great balance between that exciting, passionate response to the subject and the more academic, intellectual time that you can spend in the studio, because you can sort of decompress, set the AC where you want, turn the music on, and just focus on the ideas. And so there's a beautiful balance there between the two. And I've tried to set my life up so I can do whatever I want. If I wake up in the morning and want to go out and paint, I'll do that. If I want to stay in the studio, I can do that. And that tends to work the best for me.
What percent of your time do you think you're out in the field?
Probably 25% of the time. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the shows and whatnot want larger paintings, and I'm just not into doing large works on location.
Yeah, because I do think of you, I really do, as being one of those artists that relishes being out in the desert, especially 110. You relish being in the places where no one has been and capturing those moments in essence of solitude, really.
I tell you what, if you really love the outdoors, then you're going to want to be out there like I do. And I kind of enjoy a sense of adventure with my time outdoors. So I like exploring and I'll just start walking down the desert washes out in the Superstition. And, 4 hours later, I've gone 6 miles into this obscure deep canyon that I never even knew existed. And set up and paint. I have a quad that I can ride up some of these washes. And I like that. I like being out there. I like painting while I'm out there. It's really enjoyable.
You must really be able to relate to Maynard Dixon.
I tell you, he was one tough cookie, that guy.
Yeah.
hanging around in Tempe in August or whatever when it was.
Yeah, and 1915 and 1915 both.
Yeah, no AC. I mean.
Oh yeah. Now, I have a little drawing that he did in Mojave that was done in the 19, right at night. It was July of 1900, and it's called 122 in the Shade.
Titled
it. Wow. It must have just been brutal. And they thought he was just a madman. Everyone who would run across him in the desert at that time just thought, what is this guy doing? Who is he? And what does that mean? You're out here painting and drawing. And occasionally you must have people come across you too, out in the middle of a obscure Superstition mountain canyon going, what are you in?
I've had that many times. Yeah, that some of them will keep a distance until they've fully figured out what I'm doing. They think I'm a crazy man.
Yeah.
And then when they come along, riders on horseback, they think, wow, that's pretty interesting. Never seen that before.
Yeah. Yeah, you must have that, whatever that emotional essence is when you feel that and sense it, I guarantee you Dixon had the same exact feel. You were compadres in that in that way with, you know, and the only way you get to feel that is doing it. And very few people do that.
Well, it's true. To be, first of all, to be compared to Maynard or aligned with him in any way is a great honor. He was just absolutely one of the best, but
Are you, my friend. Let me tell you,
you're very kind.
I have told many people that you're one of the best plein air painters in the world. You know, that you're looking at a guy who really understands his craft.
Well, Mark, I greatly appreciate that. It's been a long and fun journey. I have some great friends that I get together with and travel with. As a matter of fact, I was just with several of them up in southwestern Colorado painting the fall color. So there are some like-minded folks out there. A lot of people just sort of out of the back of their car, which is fine. Do whatever you want. But if you're going to paint the landscape and you think you're smart enough to do it without going outside, I've got news for you. You know.
What is that about that you have to do it? I mean, as an artist, what do you get from that? And I agree with you, by the way. But what do you get from that that you can't get from a photo? You can't get from rolling down your window?
Well, I tell you what, first of all, you're forced to stand there and observe your subject firsthand while you're painting for at least two, three hours. Even if the painting doesn't succeed, you force yourself to study for 2 or 3 hours. And you do that over time and you begin to build up a library of information in your mind that you can pull from when you have less than perfect reference, which is all photography, period. You're dealing with distortion of the lens from wide angle, compression of planes if you're telephoto, bad exposure with your darks or lights or colors too amped up. Oftentimes people don't fully realize it's not right because they see photography as visual truth. When in fact it's riddled with problems. And the best way to understand what those problems are is to observe what's in front of you firsthand over a long period of time. Plus you just connect emotionally with your subject. I get to some of these areas where I get so excited and so amped up. Nobody else is around. There might be, something's crawling around in the bush behind you. So you're a little kind of wondering what that is. And all that excitement works itself into the painting and just takes it to a different level than just standing and looking at a two-dimensional photograph or monitor in your studio.
Do you take photos when you're there, when you're doing that, or do you strictly stick to your canvas boards?
I take photographs all the time. As a matter of fact, I'm a little different. I don't know if you can see behind me. My easel's behind me, and I have a one of those high-definition Apple monitors that I can project images up onto for reference when I'm painting. But to be honest with you, Mark, I prefer 4x6 inch prints because they're even worse. and so it really forces you to stop and say, okay, something's wrong here. Where is it? What is it? And by doing that, you analyze the reference more and you understand it more, and then you're more involved. Some of these images that pop up, they're backlit on this monitor here, are so beautiful that you just stand there in awe. And I find the better they are, the more you want to copy them sort of verbatim, if you will.
And so you'll take the photographs, and then when you get to a specific point that you really moves you or you see something there compositionally, you set up, you put your easel out, you do a 10x14 or 12x16 or whatever you're going to paint on, you work for 2 or 3 hours at it, and then you take more reference of where you were so you can, if you decide to go further in the studio with that painting to be a larger painting, you have that reference as well. Would that kind of be correct?
Yes. Yep. So some of those I might not do anything with in the studio. Some of them I will keep here. I don't ever let them out because there might be something in that, a combination of colors or value relationships or whatever that I can use in multiple paintings. So I'll work from those. I'll work from the photographs and I alter things considerably even when I'm on location. I'll move elements around just because I think it would make for a better design.
So if you're looking at a mountain range and a tree and you're painting it plein air right there, at that very moment, you might move a tree or something to a different a relationship in the painting that does not really exist. Is that true? Is that a true
correct
story? Oh, that's correct. I didn't know. See, I learned something. Yay.
Yeah, you can't, obviously you can't move a giant boulder or a tree physically. You can walk around and try to compose it in relation to, let's say, a dominant peak in the background. But when I can't do that anymore, then I just go ahead and do it in the painting. And I think that for me, it makes it more exciting. It makes it more enjoyable because I can be more involved in the creative process. A lot of artists paint exactly what they see. They'll measure it, the height of the tree versus the width versus the negative spacing and all that. And I've even talked to them when I'm out in the field and I'll say, but don't you think it'd look better over there? They look at me like, you can't do that. but sure you can. Sure you can.
And do they try it once you mention it or say, look?
Some of them will. I get that a lot in the online class. They're kind of surprised. God, I didn't think you could do that. Sure, it's a painting.
Yeah, well, Dixon would do that kind of stuff for sure. I mean, he would, you know, change things or eliminate things in the moment if he felt it was. I think like all artists that get better at their craft, you realize that sometimes you don't need everything. That, you know, cleaning, being simplistic sometimes can be more powerful than getting every branch and every little tree limb and all that kind of stuff. I imagine that's true for you too.
Well, that's a fascinating thing about Dixon. I mean, towards the end there, he was a master at editing, and he would distill these paintings down into just big, simple graphic shapes. If you look at the process, if you look at his work throughout his life, the early pieces were much more rendered. You could tell he was much more into what the thing he was painting looked like. And as his life went on towards the end, he just got down to the bare bones of what it was. And he had so much knowledge at that point that he could eliminate all that and still make it believable. And those paintings are just phenomenal. And they're pretty direct, you know, those 1014s and 1620s you do on location. There wasn't a lot of fussing around, but the guy was such an extraordinary draftsman that he could pull it off. And there aren't many people. A contemporary who does that would be Ned Jacob. He's not real thick with his application, but he's such an extraordinary draftsman that he can pull it off, and you're just amazed at how the beautiful lyrical line quality of the work.
Well, Dixon working from 1917 to 21 at Foster and Kleiser, that big advertising company, the biggest in San Francisco, he said that really gave him more understanding about composition than anything. And he said it was really instrumental in him becoming a really great painter was that time that he worked as, you know, doing ad stuff, billboards mainly. It allowed him to work on composition.
Yep. And it paid off.
Yeah, it did. Well, he made a living as an artist. You know, he was never wealthy. He had two homes, which was good. And he always had food on his table, and he was able to support three children and three wives for that matter. But he was able to make a living as a painter. That was his most successful thing of his life, that he said that he was able to, you know, make a living doing just art for a living. And that's a hard thing. People don't realize that, right? I mean, it's tough.
You'd be amazed at the number of professional artists of note who have a working spouse. It is very difficult to make a living at painting. It's not easy. It's not easy.
And I think that's probably, maybe you want to address this because you do have you are a teacher and you've done it for 30 years. You're well respected as that. What do you tell your students who go, yeah, I want to be you?
I tell them to work hard. I don't talk negatively to students about making a living at it because I don't want to discourage them. I was a little bit reluctant to say it here. But it can be done, you know. I had a student once who was approaching retirement, and I won't tell you what he did, but he made a lot of money. And he asked me, how long do you think it will take before I can make that kind of money? I said, I have no answer for you. I didn't want to discourage him, but it was not possible. It wasn't going to happen because he wasn't, he hadn't been doing it that long. And when I got out of school in 85, it was 5 years before I got a painting off my easel that I said, quote, now that's saying something. That's working for me a little bit. That's going in the direction of what I want to say. And then the next year it was two, and then it started feeding on itself. So I was working full time at it. I was at the easel full time, indoors and outdoors, for 5 years, after painting for 5 years while I got my degree, before things really started working out for me. Now I will say this, I wasn't a very good painter. And so I had nowhere to go but up, but it's been a kind of continual growth process for me. And that's kept it really exciting. I've seen some really terrific artists, very young, in their early 20s, who just come out of the chute, just fabulous artists. And you never see it change in their work. It's just sort of this same thing. It's good work, but that would get old after a while, it seems to me. So it's best to start lousy and keep the growth going from there on out. And I think if you get in front of your subject and paint from life, that's where the real excitement's going to be. That's where it's going to keep it fresh. That's where the growth is going to happen. And it keeps you from the influences of the market that can be damaging if you're not careful with it.
And what do you mean when you say that with regards to the market that can be damaging?
So as you know, as well as anybody, I do a lot of small paintings. And the reason is because I spend a lot of time in the field. In the beginning, I spent almost all my time in the field. So I was working on up to say a 12x16 format. I spent so long doing that it kept me from really learning how to develop a larger format, you know, the surface, because I wanted to look to that surface as well as to stay loyal to the subject. So that hurt me a little bit. So I don't, I never really got excited about doing really large paintings. I'll work up to a 30-40 or so. The point of that whole story is a lot of these shows are, hey, Matt, why don't you push yourself and go a little larger? And I say, well, that's not what I do. But if this is what you're looking for, I can give you plenty of this.
Right.
Because my goal is to do the best I can rather than what the market says. I've had a gallery say, hey, listen, we'll pay for you to go to Paris and paint some Paris street scenes. You can come back and have a show and we can do that. I think it could do really well. And I say, I've lived in France. I've traveled to France. It's a wonderful place, but I'd much rather go out and paint a saguaro against a big, simple backlit cliff.
Yeah. You know what? It amazes me that a gallerist would say that too, because any gallerist that knows anything about artists and artwork knows, or should know, the best stuff comes from deep within. And you have to have an emotional connection to that subject to be able to promote it, to put it on the canvas, to have a connection and to have the interest to do it. You know, if you're not interested in, you know, the Eiffel Tower, you're going to do a half-assed job of a painting. It's, you know, you might be able to make it look well, but it's not going to have any emotional pull. And it's funny you mentioned saguaros, because you clearly have an emotional pull to saguaros because you paint them as well as anyone. And they're super hard to paint. They're very difficult. It's one of the things I use as a criteria when I'm looking at an artist. I want to see what they can do with saguaros and with clouds. Because I know if they can paint a saguaro, that then they've examined it, they understand their thing, and then that they can paint. So, you know, it's a little shocking that a gallerist would do that, but, you know, I don't think they get what an artist is, maybe.
Well, there are a lot of artists who are willing to do that. So it just depends on the individual. It's not a right or wrong. It's what they want to do. But I agree with you on, if you're doing what you want to do, the best paintings are gonna come out of that. You know, and for me, quality, there's no relationship between size and quality. Right. A great little 8x10 beats the hell out of a mediocre 30x40 in my book.
Oh, absolutely.
So there's a sense of pride that comes with a successful painting, regardless of size. So it never really bothered me. But that's just me.
Yeah, and it doesn't bother me. I don't care as a gallerist. I want your best work. You know, whether it's big, medium, small, or whatever. I don't really look at it as, I think some gallerists want it because they want big things because they make more money on it, or it's more valuable. But for me, it's really about the artwork. You know, does it ring true? Is it something I get in and go, oh my God, look at that. How in the world did that guy do that or girl do that? You know, they got it. Oh my God, that's just, and I get chills when I see one of those paintings that just, you know, just has that, you know, that sense of the moment, and then had the skill set, which was, you know, takes, as you said, 10 years in your case and 10,000 hours for most, to be able to pull that off.
Yep. Yep. I tell you what, I collect art too. And
I know you do. You're a big collector.
I'm a big collector of small works because I can afford small works and the quality I want. And they're great. I have them all over my house. They add such richness to my life. And they're so fun to look at, to get you. I've got this little Hansen putt-up that I just love getting my face in this painting. It's a 10-12. The way he glazed it, real narrow value range. It's just a beautiful little painting. And boy, that's all I need.
Yeah, you know? I agree. One of my most favorite paintings that I have, deceased paintings, is probably 10-14, is an Armin Hansen rodeo scene from 1930. The way that he was able to capture the motion and the color and the essence of that moment in time and of early rodeo is mind-boggling. I'll send you an image, but it's not for sale or trade, nothing. I love it.
Love to see it.
Yeah. So when you finish, so you start and you get with Trailside, I'm just going to backtrack a little bit. What happens to your career after that?
Well, the first year I was in the gallery, I think they sold maybe three paintings for me. The second year in the gallery, I didn't see it coming. It just exploded.
Wow.
And they, of course, they had two galleries. They had one in Scottsdale and one in Jackson. So right. On one of those years, I think maybe 95 or 6, maybe both of them, I did shows both in Scottsdale and their Jackson locations. And they were selling a lot of paintings for me. Once you're in Trailside, all the other galleries start looking at you because they were really rocking it back then in the early and mid-90s, all through the 90s. And then from there, I got into a couple of the shows, the Autry Show and the Prix de West and Plein Air Painters of America, Northwest Rendezvous. So, and again, Mark, I was working, like I said a moment ago, on the smaller format, so I could say yes to more opportunities and give them the work. So I was doing pretty much everything and having a blast at it, traveling all over the country. I have a pickup truck with a camper on it with a whole shower, bathroom, kitchen, everything. I could park wherever I want and get up first thing in the morning, start painting, paint till the sunset, cook some dinner. And so I was traveling all over the place, up into Canada, up the coast, Montana, just everywhere, having a great time.
And making money.
And making a living at it, yep. But by then, by the mid-90s, I was making a very comfortable living. And certainly by 2000, it was, do whatever I wanted. Travel overseas to paint, which I did a couple times. And yeah, so.
So from 2000 to now, that's 20 years, what's happened in that time frame? How have you progressed as an artist, as a person, really?
I think my painting, there's a lot more finesse in my work, a lot more finish to it. I'm a stickler for surface and how the paint's laid down, how much paint is laid down, the mark of the tool, the calligraphy, all of it. So I've really tried to refine that. I've continued to travel and get outdoors to understand my subject, and it's more of the same. And I've also started doing a lot more larger formatted works, up to like say 30, 40, maybe a little larger than that. And I'm finally to the point where I think I can pull those off and be proud of them. So,
they're great.
So I'm working on some of those right now. And
good. Think of us.
Desert stuff too. So I need to get some new work to you.
You do. That would be, yeah. Well, and even though, you know, we're in a pandemic and you would think it's not going to be a great year, honestly, I think Tucson is going to be slammed. I have this funny feeling because it's a place that people can come and eat outdoors and feel comfortable. And in January, it might be 70 degrees. And I think there's going to be a lot of people, actually, that are going to be in Tucson this year, way more than in past years, actually.
I've actually been surprised at how good sales were. When this first went down for a good month or so, it was very quiet. And then all of a sudden, painting started selling.
Yeah,
the galleries, many of them were closed, so I started getting inquiries directly through my website. But sales were solid, and it's been it's been a good year. I can't quite figure out why or what's right. happening, but you know how the art world is. Anybody who can figure it out is going to be the rich guy. Because as soon as you have it figured out, it morphs in another direction or turns and does something else.
Well, it hasn't been 209, that's for sure.
Yeah, that one was a tough one. 9/11 didn't rock my world, but 2008 did, because it quieted a lot of the galleries and whatnot down. And but I was always doing a little teaching on the side. I loved doing the workshops. You know, I'd do anywhere from 1 to 4 of them a year. So that always sort of stabilized things a little bit. It's not something I do for a living. It's just something I do to get out and
communicate
with friends.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, though, but I think part of your legacy is going to be that, honestly. I think your legacy as a teacher and all the great artists that you have influenced over the years, and I'm sure there's tons and tons of them, some you know and probably some you don't, because they won't tell you, but I do think that's actually going to be one of your legacies, because I hear it on a regular basis. Oh yeah, I took a workshop with Matt Smith. Oh yeah, he's a great teacher. You know, that definitely is a thread that ruminates throughout the art world, I think, when it comes to you.
Well, that's nice to hear. I enjoy sharing it. When I was at ASU, I didn't throw this little tidbit in, but when I was at ASU, I took a week and ditched and went and took a Jim Reynolds workshop at Scottsdale Art School. I went to my instructors. I had 4 classes and told them I won't be here next week because of this. 2 of them said, good for you, go for it. 2 of them said, if you're not here, you're a letter grade. You're going to go down a letter grade for 2 unexcused absences. I said, I'm fine with that. I'll see you next week, the week after next. And I learned so much in that class from Jim, and he was so full of good information. And I remember how excited I was. It's like a kid at Christmas the night before that class started. And that was one of the most important experiences for me. We became friends after that. And I thought, hey, you know, if I can have that kind of influence, positive influence on anybody, then I'm in on it.
You definitely do. And yeah, there's no doubt about it. And you're making those impacts, whether you know it or not. It was funny that you bring Jim Reynolds up, that I did a podcast with Mark Maggiore a couple of days ago, and his aha moment was a Jim Reynolds painting at the Cowboy Hall of Fame, where he literally, the light bulb went off and he said, I'm going to do Western paintings. This is what I'm supposed to do. So, you know, it's funny that you both have that thread. And I'm sure there's many people that have you as the thread as well in their careers and what they can do and how they see it. And, you know, I kind of use you as a standard bearer when people, you know, want to show me their work or whatever in plain air. And I say, well, you know, this is kind of the pinnacle right here. If you want to look at that, that's where you need to shoot for. And, so I do think that may be your legacy. I mean, your paintings clearly will be there and we'll have it, but you know, it's just like this. Maybe this is my legacy. I don't even know it, right? I sell all this art and I do other things, and really it's the podcast, right? You know, because it affects people, or hopefully it affects people.
Well, you're good at it. And I'm glad you say that. Do what you love. That's what I'm doing. And that's all I can do. And if it helps people, then terrific. You have a bunch of great plein air painters in that gallery. Reggie Roberts and Greg Hull and
Jill
Glenn
Carver.
Bean. Jill, yeah. So there are a lot of them. You know, back in the day, there weren't that many people out there doing it. They were spread all over the country. Now it seems I can't go on a trip where I don't run across somebody who's out in the field painting. And which I think is exciting. It exposes people to the beauty and the importance of art. They get involved with it and share it with other folks. And
I would say almost everybody in my gallery could do it, you know, and has done it. Even people you wouldn't think could do it, or wouldn't think of them in those terms, like Howard Post, he could do a beautiful little painting, plein air. I've seen him do it. I've seen the paintings. Ed Mel, same thing. Beautiful plein air painting. Because you need that skill set, I think, to be able to pull it off as a landscape painter. And my gallery, you know, it could have been, you know, landscapepaintinggallery.com, whatever, because, you know, I love landscapes and they're very crucial to the backbone of this gallery, no doubt. And it's trying to find those individuals that have their own unique voice, because I don't want to overlap. I don't want one artist to compete with another. So it's, you know, I'm very particular about it. And then sometimes, you know, it takes 20 years to get an artist to come on board, i.e. Matt Smith. You want to share that story? I think that's a pretty good story, actually.
You know, I was trying to remember the other day when I met you. I remember where it was. It was at the Safari Hotel in Scottsdale before you had a gallery. And it was a Native American antique art show. And I remember being going to that because I always loved that stuff. And I just kept coming back to your table. It was like you had these two card tables and everything on it was beautiful. Everything on it was beautiful. You go to the other booths and they might have one or two interesting things and then a bunch of filler. And I remember visiting with you, and then I saw you at another trade show like that probably a year later, and we talked again and you remember me. So that would have been, it was like the late 80s or early 90s.
Yeah.
Maybe you remember, I don't know.
Yeah, I would have been, yeah, it probably would have been the early 90s, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Because
yeah,
I opened my gallery in 92, I think. That's when I finally...
Yeah, that was the gallery that was down a little further south. And then, gosh, when did I start showing with you? About 5 years ago?
Yeah, I would say it's been about five or six years. Though I, you know, every time I saw you for 20 years, it was like, love your work. Always will show you if you ever...
Well, the problem was, Mark, is I started with Stuart over at West in 1990, and I couldn't do both full time. So
yeah, no, and I understand that. I think as a gallerist, a good gallerist will realize that there's a relationship there, and you shouldn't be poaching artists. And all you can do is put your hat in the ring and just say, "I'm available if anything ever happens." And I'll never forget when you called and said, I am now available if you're still interested. And it was really like that, if you're still interested. And I'm like, you're damn right I'm still interested. I was interested 20 years ago. I'm interested right now.
Yeah. Well, you put your money where your mouth was. You bought one of my paintings at the Idle George show.
Yeah, great little painting.
I don't remember if it was first or second year. And obviously, I was coming to your gallery and buying baskets and weavings and a Dixon drawing or two. And
yeah,
I don't know if
we did some trades too.
Yeah, yeah, I still have that big FTJ from that show you had in Santa Fe.
That's a Frank Tenney Johnson, for those people who don't know the lingo of FTJ.
Yeah, that's one of my, the only reason I own it is because it's unsigned. It would have been out of my price range, but beautiful painting. I love it.
Yeah, it was a plein air painting. He did it in the field. You know, he was out there doing just what you're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, you know, you recognize the beauty of it. Other people who would see, you know, sketch work or studies might not get exactly what, you know, what it was, but that was a wonderful collection I got. Yeah, it came directly from Frank Tenney Johnson's widow, and the guy that I got it from, a man named Bill Riffle, you know, goodbye, you know, God bless Bill Riffle. He's not alive anymore, but you know, he got them all from Frank Tenney Johnson's widow and the framer. And so I got them all. It was a wonderful little collection. Those are the fun things that happen as an art dealer in your life. You know, you have these opportunities that you get these collections occasionally, or you get a great artist like yourself, and it may take 20 years before they actually get to show with you. But, you know, if you hang in there and if you do your job right, you might get them.
Yeah, that's one of the things that has to be exciting for you. I've been in your gallery when somebody's walked in with, you know, some jewelry or a basket or something, and I thought, wow, how great would that be to have that coming in all week? You never know what's going to come through the door, and that's got to be exciting.
It is, and it does happen, and it happens every day, not only through the gallery doors but through the internet. And you know, I'm always blown away. It's, you know, that's what I guess that's one of the excitements about it. That, and also when an artist produces a body of work, and I know they've been working on them for, you know, in some cases almost a year, and you see the work and you just like, oh my God, look at all these paintings, and you recognize the effort and energy that went into them. And you know, and there's always going to be a half a dozen that I want to own myself, you know. And it's just, you know, to me, I'm as excited as I don't know if I am as excited, but I feel like I'm as excited as the artist who brings them in. So it's fun. Yeah.
No, a good life.
Yeah, it, you know, it can be a good life if you really, if you approach it right. And, you know, I think it's funny you brought up the story of the guy who said, when will I be making this money? I'd have two questions to for you. One, is he still painting? And two, does he ever make any money?
Well, I haven't been in communication with him in regards to that. So I don't know. I don't.
Because you don't do it for the money, you know?
Yeah.
This is not a profession you do for the money.
You know, it's interesting, Mark, because I've had doctors, lawyers, politicians, you name it, in my workshops. And so they work hard at a job they maybe love, maybe not so much, and earn enough money so that they can pursue their hobby of painting. I didn't make much money and was painting full time, was having so much fun. I didn't know I was broke for those 10 years. You know, I was just, I literally was asleep under my Jeep when it was raining because I had the clearance and just so I could get up the next day out in the country, get up the next day and paint. Yeah. So when I finally got the camper with a shower in it, the kitchen, the whole nine yards, I thought, this is it. I'll never have to go home again. I'll be out painting for the rest of my life. and that's what I did at up on the Beartooth Pass here a month ago. Just drove up that road and stayed up there four nights and just painted the fall color. Nobody was up there. It was just beautiful. Just incredible.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing to do. And I guess, you know, we've kind of covered a lot of ground, and I'd like to kind of finish up with maybe you can give some advice to young artists too that want to do this as a profession. I know we talked about it a little earlier on, but, you know, who hear this and see the passion you have for it and that you've made a living, but maybe you share, you know, what is it really going to take?
Well, I tell you what, the best thing you can do is start early because it's going to take time. Focus on the fundamentals, drawing, value, design, and color. If you can, find a mentor or a good instructor or a meaningful art school. There are ateliers popping up all over now that are very structured, representational schools. Go with that first before the abstract, because the abstract is in the representational. So don't try to put the cart before the horse, and paint from direct observation, whether it's the landscape or a still life or a portrait or whatever it is, you architectural themes, whatever it is that interests you, and just get to work and have fun at it. It's a long haul, but it's a rewarding and enjoyable life, and I can't imagine doing anything else.
Yeah.
And it's worth the effort. You'll always have it. Worst case scenario is you'll always have that to take some of the stress off your life, or do when you're on your summer vacation in Rocky Mountain National Park or Capitol Reef or somewhere. So that's worst case scenario, but jump into it as early as possible and take it very seriously.
Yeah, I think that's right. I agree with all that you said. And it does take time. You know, but if you put the effort, I don't care. I think even if you have mediocre skill set, if you really want it and you really put the effort, you can become a competent painter.
Oh, sure. So I did. I had a workshop once, and 21-year-old young fella showed up in that workshop, and he's somebody you represent named Logan Hajej. And I knew from the moment he was in there and I saw his paintings and just the nature of the questions he was asking that this guy was going to rock it. And it still took a while as he developed what he was doing. And he's an extraordinary draftsman and painter from life and has done well. And I've had quite a few young guys like that. And it's rewarding to watch them develop like that.
Yeah, I've gone out.
You've got to put the work in.
I've gone out with him and Glenn and Glenn Dean and Josh Elliott and watched them paint in plein air and see what they can do. And they have the chops, you know.
Yeah.
They do.
And Glenn Dean was another one. And, even Russell Case took one of my classes. I knew who he was, but I hadn't met him. And when he told me his name, I said, what are you doing in here? I should be in your workshop.
Well, that shows the humility that he's willing to try to get better, even, you know, though others might think, oh, he doesn't need it. In his own mind, he feels like he wants to be able to push it to another level. And if he can pick up one thing that he didn't know or didn't understand or didn't quite see how to manipulate it, that, you know, that it makes him a better painter. That means, you know, that's a guy who wants it.
Yeah, that's so true. And all those fellows are the same way. You know, you can't buy into your own press and you just have to shoot for the best. And one of the smartest things anybody can do is always look at work that's better than yours.
Yep.
Because you'll be reaching for it instead of looking back on. I never understood why somebody would try to imitate a really great painter like, let's just make up Frank Tenney Johnson. Why would you want to imitate the best, you know, one of the Western Horseman painters out there? Why don't you take some mid-rate guy and blow past him? or Frederick Remington or something like that. But the art market right now is just filled with derivative painters. And if you spend any time at all with your subject and have an open mind, you'll come up with ideas, just great ideas are out there everywhere. And that's half the fun of being out there is, God, look at that. I never would have thought about that in the studio. And it's right there. So I've got to paint it.
Yeah, that's got to be exciting when you see it and recognize it at that moment going, ah, there it is. That's why yep. I like down this damn canyon in 110 degrees and put my pipe at
one of your friends walks up behind you and say, what are you painting? What are you painting that for? What are you looking at?
How many cougars have you seen out in the desert? How many encounters have you had? You must have had a couple.
Not one mountain lion. I've never seen a mountain lion in a while, but I've come face to face with a grizzly, bobcats, coyotes, more rattlesnakes and tarantulas than you can think about. I was out painting once with the late Mimi Litchauer, and my backpack was down on the ground, and she came up to see what I was working on. She just screamed out and looked down. There's a giant tarantula in my backpack. But, you know, you just pay attention to what's going on around you, and you'll probably be okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The grizz does not sound fun. That is not a good one.
That was not a good one.
Yeah.
That was not good.
They scare me. I've run in a couple of mountain lions, but I don't want to run into a grizzly ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it's wonderful to have you in the gallery. You're a joy to look at your artwork, which I do on a regular basis. And do you have any of your teaching events coming up that anybody can look at if they want to sign up? Do you have anything like that going on right now if they want to try to study under you?
Yes, I do. And thank you for saying that. It's an honor to show in your gallery. I always wanted to be there, Mark, as you walk in your gallery and everything in there is just extraordinary. Right. So it's my privilege. Yes, my online class opens for registration with it's Tucson Art Academy Online. On November 5th, my in-person workshops are the only one I have coming up is in February with Scottsdale Artist School, but it's a four-person with Dan Young, Skip Whitcomb, and Mitch Baird. It is to benefit the Planar Painters of America. It's one of our annual workshops. And those are the only two I have coming up that aren't full right now.
Okay. Yeah, we'll try to get this out ASAP so they can get the workshop online when it starts November 4th, because that's coming up right away.
Yeah, November 5th, I think it opens. Yeah, but no, thanks. I appreciate the plug.
Yeah, no.
Don't know that I need many more people, but if they come on, I'll take care of them.
And also follow you on Instagram, because I do that. I like looking at your Instagram. You always have beautiful work, and I think it's really interesting. So, you know,
I'll
give you that plug that people should follow you on Instagram.
Appreciate that.
All right. Well, thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate all you do for us. I love your work. You know, what can I say? Your name is synonymous with, you know, being a high achiever and one of the best in your field, I think. So.
Well, I sure appreciate that, Mark. It's an honor to show with you, and I'll get some paintings down to you soon. I've been a bad boy with that. So.
Yeah. Well, I should be more aggressive. I know I don't do that so much. I try to more of a hands-off kind of guy, because I like my artists to not feel like I'm always pressuring them to, you know, get me material. I think it's better when it comes organically. Maybe that's not a good thing, but, you know, that's kind of the person I am, I guess.
Okay, well, I have some things stacking up around here because I just haven't been sending anything out much to the galleries with COVID, just because many of them were closed. The shows were too, so... yeah, so I'll get something to you soon.
Yeah, do. All right, thank you. Matt Smith, thank you very much. We'll see you. I don't know if we'll see you in person anytime soon. I hope so. I guess if you bring me down some artwork, we will. Let me know if you're coming.
I'll do it soon. Thanks so much, Mark.
Right, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right.